This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A failing high school in North Las Vegas, Nevada, was given a chance to remake itself and change the lives of some struggling students. Now, less than 2 years later, the experiment is paying off.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They all want to come here. They want to stay here all day. They don't want to go to their other classes. I have to make them sometimes.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll take a tour of Desert Rose High School and hear how students from all over the region are buying into their new program. We'll also hear how a college in New England is celebrating its history and spend an academic minute learning about a growing social movement, neurodiversity. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The school district in Clark County, Nevada, is the fifth largest district in the U.S., with over 320,000 students enrolled in K-12. The district encompasses 358 schools and is the largest employer in the state. Recently, I got a chance to visit one of those schools. Desert Rose High School is located in North Las Vegas and, just a short time ago, was given a very different mission.
And they're going to build it so they can hang equipment on it.
After walking in the door at Desert Rose High School, you never know what you might run into when you turn a corner. The school, which is situated on acres of rocky desert terrain in North Las Vegas, offers students career training in everything from welding and construction technology to electrical wiring and nursing. Kerry Larnard is the director of career tech education for the Clark County School District and the principal of Desert Rose High. The school recently hosted a tour for some education journalists to show off their facility and their methods. We spoke about the school as we walked through the halls.
What was this place before it became this place?
He should answer that. The school was a credit recovery school for a lot of students who weren't really making it in their high schools as well as adult education. There were these programs here with the exception of manufacturing, but the school was really where kids would show up. You might have two or three students in a class at any given time, and it really wasn't being utilized as it probably could be. But the kids were doing a lot of credit retrieval classes, and then these were really just more elective classes. They weren't completing programs of study. They weren't getting really past that first year in any particular program, and so when we took it over, we just had way different goals for what we were doing here. So we don't have the behavior problems that sometimes they did. Our attendance is, they can't miss more than 3 days a semester to stay in our programs. And so we just have really changed the dynamic, and you can see with the classes we've already been in, it's all about student engagement and being in there, getting their hands dirty, working immediately, and the teachers kind of standing back and facilitating that work.
How to build a house. It's residential construction.
Bruce Nelson teaches construction technology at Desert Rose.
So it's everything you would do to build a house except for HVAC. We don't do air conditioning. We teach them a little bit of plumbing, a little bit of electrical, framing, insulation, siding, roofing, the whole bit. So there's about 20 different areas you go into.
Once they get out of this program, would you let them build your house?
If they were with me for 2 or 3 years, yes.
Okay.
Once they had enough experience. I used to hire a lot of the kids to work for me. I did side jobs, you know, when I wasn't teaching. And I used to have 2 or 3 of them working for me almost all the time. So great experience for them, and it was a good help for me. This is just, it's a kicking, starting off point for them. So just depending how dedicated they are, they can learn a lot while they're here.
Do you find they're dedicated? Is this someplace they want to be during the day?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They all want to come here. They want to stay here all day. They don't want to go to their other classes. I have to make them sometimes.
And it's that hands-on experience with the goal of a future career that has students buying into the program.
Just getting them using their hands. You know, we have really moved away from that traditional vocational education, and now these businesses are struggling because we don't have skilled tradesmen and women. We don't have people with basic skills so that they can get a job to propel themselves forward. And so our focus here was really to make sure that we were not only having the kids come and have this great experience, but that they were going to walk out with some type of industry certification so that they could have their high school diploma and something to help them get it into the job market.
Obviously, it's an experimental program. How easy or not so easy was it to get this started?
It was a little challenging. It was really It was just an idea, and I had some folks around me who were really great contributors on how we could make something like this work. Quite a few years ago, there was a similar program, and it kind of fell apart a little bit in Clark County. But we really were trying to focus on how to give students in the North Las Vegas community access, because they didn't have access to some of these type of programs in their schools. And so doing this was really, first, our ability to do that, and that was probably the easy sell, was when we tried getting our school board on board to help fund some of this, and when we started securing some career technical education funding to make this happen, when you realize the students that we're going to be pulling from, the opportunities and the access we could finally give them, it wasn't so hard selling it necessarily, but we have been in a budget crisis in the Clark County School District. In the 6 years that I was a principal, we probably had over $500 million in budget cuts within our district alone. And so asking for money to start a program like this was kind of a daring ask, but I think people saw the value and saw what the potential could be, and so we were able to make it happen.
And students don't come here for the full day, right?
No, they are here typically, depending on their schedules, but students are here between probably 7 to 9 hours a week, depending on their school. So they come in larger chunks of time and typically every other day.
Coordination with other schools, transportation, that sounds easy.
Well, when I started this project, I was still a high school principal, and so the principals that I went to were people that I had worked with as a colleague. And so going to them was a little daunting, but they were all very open to it. And the reality is, when you are a principal in a high school, you're looking for anything that's going to benefit your kids. And when you can't offer it yourself, and if something comes before you where you know your kiddos can benefit, They were the easiest to jump on board. And so working out the logistics was a little more difficult, but getting those principals to buy in was really pretty easy. It was getting the funding sources and those other pieces that took a longer period of time. But those principals, I went to them with the idea early on. Then I went back a couple months later and said, okay, I think this is going to be a go. And then we got notified that it was going to go the last 2 weeks of school. And I said, I'm sorry, but we got to come out and actually recruit so we have kids to go. And they opened up their doors and said, let's see what we can do.
This is a little A-frame that my team...
In Las Vegas alone, and by June of 2020, they will be in need of 5,000 welders.
Ziola Braxton is the assistant principal at Desert Rose Technical Center.
So we were very strategic in the programs that we chose, and we chose programs that we knew that job opportunities in the next 5 years were going to be amazing, and students were very likely going to be able to find a job and a career upon graduation.
How unique is this program?
Well, it's really one of its kind in the Clark County School District right now, and we're hoping that in the future we'll be able to provide schools like this in other parts of the school district. But for now, this is our second year, and this is the only school that has a structure like this, to where we have the programs, but we bus students in from different high schools in the neighborhood.
Do you feel there are an awful lot of eyeballs on you saying, okay, let's see how this works?
We do, but we also, I'm welcome to the challenge, because I know what's good for kids, and I know that the opportunities are amazing for our students. And so, yes, but I think that we're doing good things, and I'm looking forward to be able to expand our programs more.
Yeah, because don't get me wrong, they're just learning. So do they make the mistakes? Yes. That panel up there is a perfect one to take a picture of. I just wanted to show you because it's all ready to plug in.
So Daniel Topps teaches electrical wiring in a building out back of the school. Inside that building, there's a series of rooms. They don't have wall boards up, it's just the wood frame. He says his students are taught to wire a room, then break it down and do it all over again, again and again.
Being an electrician's repetitiveness is doing the same thing over and over and over and just getting better and better at it. So they get a project two, and I add what we call GFCIs into it. I add a doorbell, and then they learn all those things. They break it down, and then they get three-way switches. I start showing them how to bend conduit, and they could pull wire through conduit, which that cubicle over there, because they're students from last year, they have their conduit bent for this year and everything. So, and so on and so on. So they get six projects to do, and if they get through three of them, I'm okay with sending them out to a contractor. I have contractors who do call me for apprentices, is what we call them, and I let them know, You know, they are about a first-year apprentice. Exactly. They shouldn't be off working by themselves. Let them work with a journeyman for a while. No live, nothing live. Like, apprentices aren't supposed to work with nothing live. And that's how I treat them.
Put ceiling fans up here?
I do. Yeah. Actually, in Project 3, there are ceiling fans.
Okay, cool.
So they do learn ceiling fans as well. And they learn how to put two different switches on. One, you know, obviously, if you're in a house, sometimes you put a switch on and you got to use the light or the fan to control it. I teach them how to just use two switches, one to turn the light on, one to turn the fan on. They should know those things.
Walking around the school, you see students in safety equipment building and welding and being totally engaged in the programs. Desert Rose principal Carrie Larnard says when the program was getting started, they specifically looked for students who needed some direction.
Students who were kind of on the cusp, those kids who aren't necessarily engaged in school, maybe your C, possibly D average student who just needs something, and maybe just something that could light that candle underneath them to get them moving a little bit better. We weren't looking for kids with clean discipline records, and we weren't looking for kids with stellar attendance. We wanted kids who, if we could give them something, it could help them be more successful, not only back at their high school, but moving into a career or a pathway to community college or college as well. And we've been pleasantly surprised and successful. You know, you never know when you set a bar pretty high for kids who aren't typically thought of on their campus as your honors or your top students, and we just laid down the law and the kids met it and really have done incredibly well here.
We also want students who may not have an idea of what they want to do upon graduation.
Again, assistant principal Ziola Braxton.
The college path may not be what they want right after high school. And so we want them to know that college opportunities are available to them. But if they're interested in going and working after high school, then now you have that degree, but you also have a skill where you can go out and work if you choose to do so. And also the programs that we chose, students will be able to find good paying careers in these fields. So it's students that may not necessarily want have an idea of what they want to do at this moment, and we try to guide them to the path that they would like.
For students to continue to attend the program at Desert Rose, they are responsible to keep up their grades at their home high schools. Charles Thompson is the go-to guy for students who might need a little help. Or a lot.
If a kid come here and I get a progress report, and I notice the kid is not doing well in the math class or whatever, I would get back with the school and say, look, is there anything that we can do on this end over here that we can bring his math skill up? We got teachers next door that will come over and help them with their math. Or we get one of the teachers here, spend like 30 minutes out of the class to show them math strategies to help improve their grade.
If the grades don't go up, then they have to miss time here?
Sure. But so far, we never had that. Everybody been on track. They've been improving the grades and everything.
Mr. Thompson says that math is the most common subject students come to him for help with. And lately, he's been assisting some students where English is their second language. He also teaches other skills for students entering the workforce.
I teach them mock interview skills. So we've been very successful. Kids go out and get jobs. I show them how to do a resume, how to do the cover letter, how to do the after interview, stuff like that.
This is year two of the program at Desert Rose High School and the Desert Rose Technical Center. Director Carrie Larnard says she's encouraged with the direction of the program and the enthusiasm of the students and teachers. And she sees a future where the program can grow.
I think what I love most about this, being in the position I am now as the director of CTE, is that we're getting a better return on our investment. This equipment that you see in these classrooms, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment in these classes that we've walked into. And with that, we are servicing 5 different high schools. Every single period of every single day, the classes are full. And so we're using that equipment all the time. It's not sitting idle, and that allows us to put this kind of money into programs like this. So when I look into the future, I see our regular schools, not our magnet, not our schools where you have to apply to get in, but our regular high schools having an ability to work with high schools in their area to say, I'll buy this particular equipment, or we'll start this program here and you can send your kids here and then I can send my kids to you. Like, maybe we'll do medical, you do construction, we'll do auto, you do biotech. I mean, it does, you know, and just really try and build those partnerships. And it's okay for kids to have different schedules. And it's okay for it to not look typical day to day. If these kids can walk out with more than that high school diploma, that's got to be our goal.
The Desert Rose Technical Center currently offers 6 programs: nursing, medical assisting, welding, building technology, electrical wiring, and manufacturing. All the classes are full for the school year. Thanks again to the Education Writers Association for offering us a scholarship to attend their higher education seminar this past September in Las Vegas, and for arranging this tour of Desert Rose High. Still to come, a college in New England is taking a look back at its own history. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Williams College is a private liberal arts college in Williamstown, Massachusetts, a small town near the northwest corner of the state. In August 1968, a box was discovered in the basement of a dormitory at the school. In that box were 64 objects, including rocks, weapons, footwear, and, well, some objects that have yet to be identified, that were collected a century and a half earlier for the Williams College Lyceum of Natural History, a student-run museum that was on the campus from 1835 to 1908. Drawing from campus collections from the college archives, the biology department, and the museum, there is now an exhibition of these artifacts at the Williams College Museum of Art, in which the school takes a look back at its own history with a stop off in Hawaii. For The Best of Our Knowledge, Josh Landes reports.
The Williams College Museum of Art, or WICMA, is presenting The Field is the World, Williams, Hawaii, and Material Histories in the Making, in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
And the story kind of starts with the discovery, or rediscovery, of a box in the basement of a nearby dorm in 1986.
Sonnet Coggins is the Associate Director for Academic and Public Engagement at WICMA, and one of the exhibition's co-curators. She says the box contained about 64 objects gathered over a century before.
The collection was part of a natural history museum that was made entirely by students, starting in 1835. And they did this because they didn't have sciences in the disciplines. So they went out on expeditions, they got gifts from missionaries, they got gifts from institutions like the Smithsonian that had just been created to build a cabinet in order to learn about the natural world.
Their travels brought them across the world, from Florida to Greenland. It was a revolutionary period in the natural sciences, as Charles Darwin published his findings on evolution. The museum went defunct in 1908, and its contents were scattered across the Williams campus.
And so this show kind of pulls those objects out of storage because they haven't been looked at since they were acquired, and starts asking questions about how they made their way to the museum and what collecting meant then and what it means now and what it means that these objects have been sitting in our basement and not used for 40 years now.
When we started this project, we were thinking about what are the histories that lie latent on this campus.
That's Kailani Polzak, an assistant professor in the Williams Art Department. She focuses her scholarship on European art of the 18th and 19th century and the construction of race and visual culture.
The centerpiece of this gallery is a kupe'e niho ilio, or an adornment made from dog teeth that came from Hawaii, likely made in the 19th century.
As with other rediscovered items in the box, Polzak said she and Coggins used the dog tooth ankle adornment to examine the college's relationship to Hawaii.
We took that object as our starting point, and then we went to the college archives, so from WICMA to college archives, and we found the papers of Samuel Chapman Armstrong, an alum of Williams class of 1862, born on Maui, and is very famous in the United States for founding the Hampton Institute, now Hampton University.
Pulling at the thread of Williams and Hawaii led to even more revelations about the unlikely connection between the disparate locations, like how the college's missionary tradition in the 19th century created a pipeline across North America.
We found in the course of our research for this exhibition that there were 30 Williams students who either came from Williams and then went to Hawaii as missionaries, or were born to missionary families in Hawaii, came to Williams and went back. And 30 during the course of the 19th century is a good number, especially considering that for a good portion of that century, there isn't a transcontinental railroad.
The exhibition features recordings of faculty and students the curators interviewed in the making of the gallery, weaving contemporary voices about Williams into an examination of its history. One student, Nalamaku Aseng, class of 2021, even learned how to write and compose in traditional Hawaiian song to create a contemporary piece for the exhibition.
He begins by saying that the earth shakes, and ultimately the ʻole is a call to his ancestors to speak. And that speaks again to the larger project of this gallery, which is bringing voices in. All of these objects can float around in a disembodied sense, but these are the histories of real people. And so he's asking his ancestors to speak and be present in this space where their voices haven't been heard potentially ever before.
The field is the world. Williams, Hawaii, and Material Histories in the Making will be at WICMA through January 2nd, 2019.
That report from the Best of Our Knowledge is Josh Landes. There's a growing movement that supports people with a diversity of neurological conditions, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Neurodiversity is a growing social movement. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, President of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ken Gabo, Professor of Psychology at Landmark College, discusses this movement and how it can help find strengths where only weakness was seen before.
Diversity is generally considered a desirable characteristic, providing richness to our natural landscapes and a variety of experiences within our social fabric. The concept neurodiversity, a term used to describe the multitude of naturally occurring variations in the human nervous system, has been gaining steam of late. People who are autistic or have attention deficit disorder or dyslexia are starting to see themselves as neurodivergent, and for many, it becomes an important part of their identities. Yes, these conditions can evoke frustration or even aggravation for an individual when experiencing difficulty at school, work, or in social settings, yet they frequently also impart advantages and strengths. Many autistic individuals have strong memories and ability to follow complex procedures, while those with dyslexia often have strong abilities in the areas of spatial judgment and pattern recognition. Neurodiversity is also a growing social movement. Thinking about it in this way challenges the notion of what is considered normal and what is considered a disorder. This concept has the potential to influence our approach to education or other social constructs by focusing on human variation and strength more than symptoms and treatments. In support of this idea, a handful of colleges and universities have established neurodiversity centers, work programs, and conferences. By building communities and classrooms in which a wider range of people thrive, we can showcase and develop strengths and foster a sense of respect and pride. In the end, society benefits from a greater diversity of thinkers and problem solvers. Embracing neurodiversity as a movement moves all of us forward.
That was Ken Gabo of Landmark College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.